So unfortunately, we just wanted to start out to say that Stefano Monti was in a bicycle accident yesterday evening, and he wanted us to ensure that we tell all of you that he sincerely regrets that he's not able to present today. I think that's pretty understandable, Stefano. Indeed, we're wishing him a full and speedy recovery. We may be able to record his presentation at a later date after his recovery to add to the archive. So if we're able to do that, we'll let everyone know who's registered when that presentation is added to the archive. But we still are going to be hearing two excellent presentations from Dr. Stephen Ferguson and Dr. Manish Arora today, who will be discussing emerging methods to better link exposure to latent disease risk. So first, we're going to hear from Dr. Stephen Ferguson. He's a scientist at the National Toxicology Program, or NTP, division of NIEHS. I mean, you heard from Brian Barrage, the scientific of NTP in the first session. Dr. Ferguson's primary role is to lead efforts within NTP to develop, quantify, and apply physiologically relevant in vitro models that integrate informative assay approaches and unravel the dynamics of cellular responses to chemical exposure for human translation. Ferguson's current research focuses on the development of an organotypic liver model to better reflect tissue functionality and liver-like xenobiotic metabolism competence. These models are being integrated with data-rich molecular assay platforms and cellular phenotypes to explore chemical biological interactions and toxicity potential. Prior to joining NTP, Steve led the ADME Tox R&D program of Life Technologies, developing predictive in vitro liver models and assay approaches for estimation of human drug metabolism, transport, liver toxicity, and drug-drug interactions. Steve received his BS and PhD in chemistry from NC State University and currently serves as an adjunct faculty to the curriculum in toxicology at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Ferguson, thank you so much for taking the time to present to us today, and I'm now going to turn this over to you.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you to the organizers for giving us an opportunity to really talk about an important topic. And I think as we think about the sea of chemicals that we're all exposed to, this topic is relevant. And I think that a lot of exciting progress is going on in the field to begin to enable us to better understand not only these sort of acute toxicity responses that have been sort of notoriously observed, but also the more latent, the more slow developing processes that can happen in response to chemical exposures that lead to susceptibility to disease. And so there's really been an explosion in the biomedical research field in the last decade or so. And one of the main drivers of that has been the discoveries in cell biology that three-dimensional culture models that mimic more complex processes in microphysiological systems, are really beginning to display clinical and histopathology phenotypes and modeling not only sort of normal human function, but also genetically driven disease states. And one of the things that's really been focused there is mimicking these disease states. However, there's only been recently an emerging evidence emphasis to use in vitro systems to try to understand chemical exposures from an environmental standpoint and how those might contribute to these sort of more slower developing latent disease risk areas. And so what I want to talk to you today about is some of the work we've been doing in the TOX21 program. It's going through a bit of an evolution to try to enhance the physiological relevance as we cover the expanse of chemicals that could be dealt with and try to really improve our ability to interpret data from in vitro models that's grounded in pathology, established markers of histopathology, clinical pathology, and using our knowledge of reference chemicals, pharmaceuticals, to be able to develop and qualify and eventually apply emerging toxicological approach methods that better help us understand our risks and develop a safer path forward. So with that, I just want to acknowledge, of course, that I have no financial relationships to disclose and that the statements and opinions and conclusions that are contained in my presentation do not necessarily represent the statements of NIHS, the NIH, or the U.S. government. So as many of you may have heard, NIHS for many years, including programs like the Superfund, has a significant focus on environmental exposures and disease risk. We have numerous research programs from our extramural research to our intramural research that are really pushing the envelope and helping us understand the public health challenges related to chemical exposure. And EPA has a TSCA, Toxic Substances Control Act, list of more than 85,000 chemicals that may be of concern. And the TOX 21 program is really pushed to try to partner with NIHS, US EPA, NCATS, and the FDA to try to address these larger sets of chemicals, in particular the chemicals where there's very little to no data available, and to try to contextualize these chemicals with high-throughput screening assays in context with pharmaceutical chemicals and well-studied environmental chemicals to begin to prioritize chemicals and bend them. And a lot of progress has been made in the field. We've generated as a whole more than 9,000 chemicals now have data. They've been screened through 70 high-throughput assays, actually a few more, that address more than 125 biological targets and processes, as well as 120 million data points being generated. So these data are actually publicly available resources now. If you go on PubChem or the TOX21 data browser, and you can see the link on the screen here, to be able to look at and interact with these data, across these thousands of chemicals that have been developed and evaluated. And so we're trying to contribute to these areas and understand the sort of spectrum of responses. And it's really been a great impact in the field to date as these begin to be used in next generation risk assessment activities. Also, it's key that the data driven derived from these systems be quantitatively translated into relevance to humans. And in this presentation, I will touch on a few of those types of examples. But ultimately, emerging technologies are providing tools that help us estimate human bioactivity and toxicity, which aren't necessarily the same thing, and use human cells and mechanistic signaling pathways to try to better understand where to put the focus. And that's been a great program. It's going to cover a lot of chemicals, and it's going to continue to do that. But the program actually also has some challenges. When you look at the program and using these 1536 well or very high throughput assays, we're using transformed cell lines. And we know from drug development that these kinds of model systems, while they may be great as an initial acute toxicity response, when you're thinking about the challenges of more complex, more latent disease states like nuclear receptor activation, these models are quite limited. When you think about the complex structures that you see in a liver tissue, these really don't do justice to the types of phenotypes that we'd like to be able to display as we begin to bridge chemicals with disease pathways and ultimate pathology manifestation of that in some manner that builds confidence as we screen and test chemicals towards human risk assessment. And one of the phenotypes for liver that's really a hallmark of its functionality is metabolic competence. And in my former life, we worked at Cells Direct and Life Technologies and isolated primary human hepatocytes from hundreds of donor preparations over the time I was there. And on these first three bars, what you see is the median metabolic activity for three major drug metabolizing enzymes in humans across hundreds of donor preparations. And this is sort of the benchmark. You know, if an in vitro model system is going to be able to mimic the liver, metabolism is going to be one of the key features. And what we see in our TOX21 legacy assays, which have been great for identifying specific interactions to particular molecular targets, is they're largely devoid of metabolic competence related to these cytochrome P450 enzymes. And while we have other models that are beginning to get there, two-dimensional cultures, even though they can be effective, are not quite getting to this level. And so what we want to do in the evolution of TOX21 is begin to enhance our capabilities, including conferring tissue-specific, organ-specific xenobiotic metabolism that mimics not only the parent chemical exposure, but also the exposure of naturally produced metabolites that would result from that exposure. We also want to increase the pathway coverage. Right now, I said we had roughly 70 to 125 different assays and pathways, processes that we were looking at, but we want to actually expand that. And a way to do that is to create models that better mimic the full function of the organ or tissue, and then use high-dimensional assay systems such as transcriptomics, metabolomics, high-content imaging that can help build windows into that. And we want to just not focus on individual pathways and try to figure out how to add them up, but rather let those pathways do what they do in a more organotypic setting, and then allow those dynamics to manifest in push-pull relationships to lead to the phenotypes that allow us to be less, allow us to leverage nature and biology to manifest those phenotypes. Also, as I mentioned, using immortalized and transformed cells and very short-term exposures have also been limitations. And one of the real key pushes with these models as we're starting to evolve them is instead of having a duration to last a few hours or days in culture, that you can get organotypic models that last for weeks and months in culture and maintain that highly differentiated state of activity and responsiveness to chemicals. So that's sort of the vision for the challenges that we're dealing with. And so really, we've been undergoing for the last 5 years or so an evolution in TOX21 that attempts to improve the physiological relevance of in vitro screening models by developing these more organotypic systems that enhance cellular differentiation and function, metabolic competence, in particular, that longevity I mentioned earlier, so we can begin to manifest progressions of pathology outcomes towards more established markers of toxicity and adaptive response, and even take those chemicals away so that you can see if the response was adaptive or, in fact, led to an altered trajectory of response. And then what's most important really now, given the rich history we have in animal testing, is to build confidence new approach methods and toxicological methods, and the idea being to build rodent in vitro versions where we can mimic species-specific responses and then build confidence that the platform, the biological platform, can mimic the responses in vivo and then build out the human correlates of that, and doing that in a manner that uses a parallelogram-based approach. That really strengthens your translational ability, and that's really our key goal there. In addition to the organ tissue model, and we've predominantly been working with liver, we also know that you need windows into understanding what's going on. And so multi-dimensional assay platforms have been leveraged. We're using cellular imaging and high-throughput transcriptomics. We're developing methods for metabolomics to give us windows into these. And linking these, not only these high-dimensional platforms, but also established clinical markers for liver enzymes and histopathology endpoints. You know, bringing all this together into adverse outcome pathway type frameworks that enable interpretation of the progressions of response towards latent disease progression. And ultimately, these models really are most effective when they can be quantitatively translated to humans. And this has been done in drug development for quite some time. Quantitatively estimating the metabolic clearance, the hepatic renal transport that's going on with the chemical, estimating drug-drug interactions in vitro and hepatic receptor activation, inhibition of enzymes. All these things have been sorted through on the pharmaceutical side, but it's beginning to apply them on the environmental toxicity side, where we not only have to worry about a few discrete pathways that are clinically impactful, but now we have to look at a broader sense of pathways and biological responses and assess which ones are going to be most diagnostic sort of sentinels to what's going on in the organism. And finally, extending this approach out to additional tissues, we've already started work with kidney. We have efforts going on with lung, cardiovascular, and we're and at some point in the future going to expand to many other tissues, including intestine, to look at absorption of chemicals from oral exposures. But ultimately, this approach is evolution in Tox 21. We're really excited about the path forward. Now, the most successful models have generally started by keeping the structure and the cell types and the configurations and the locations of cells from the in vivo setting as the primary compass heading. It's the goalpost. We look at these systems and we say, well, how do cells behave in vivo? What are the dynamics there? And how can we mimic subsets of that in vitro? We know that we're not going to have blood flow, for example, in many of our liver models, although some microphysiological systems are starting to move towards a more mature integrated endothelium. But the idea is to look at the structures in vivo and then use that knowledge and the understanding of how chemicals behave to be able to leverage that and create structures in vitro that are actually going to work. And if you rip these cells in a human liver or a rodent liver out of their native architecture, what happens is that those isolated cells rapidly de-differentiate. And while these can be the most predictive cells because they're isolated directly from the in vivo situation, this is a real challenge when they're only available for a few hours before they die and they're losing their metabolic activity in this case. However, if you simply try to replicate some of the structures that you see in the liver, such as these cobblestone-like domains that sort of form these cord-like structures that you see as sort of happy chains of hepatocytes, they'll begin to auto-assemble if you put them in the proper culture configuration and resemble those same types of architectures, and then you get a massive increase in the stability and the in this case, the half-life of metabolic competence that you see. And so these models now in these sandwich culture configurations can last in culture for days and maybe even a little more than a week to do not only these very acute responses like metabolism, but begin to also look at nuclear receptor activation and things that take 2, 3, 4 days to manifest and even serve as an early landmark for liver toxicity prediction. And they definitely have some utility there. And these models have been really good, but unfortunately, there are lots of models out there, and those sandwich culture models don't necessarily, they don't have the longevity to really look at latent response. And so we've actually been looking at a myriad of systems, and we have no particular affinity to any of these systems in particular. We have always considered the sort of throughput versus the low throughput versus the high throughput, and then the relative physiological relevance versus complexity. In our program, because we really are trying to test a broader set of chemicals that provide a relative context across chemicals, we tend to focus on these screening models initially that help us balance the coverage of tens to hundreds of chemicals that enable us to improve our physiological relevance, and eventually we'll be moving into these microphysiological systems as we get more complex, more refined questions that we're going to address. I wanted to give you a few stories of how we've actually been applying these kinds of models as Tox 21 has evolved and leveraging really some success stories in how pharmaceutical drugs are developed. And one of the stories that we've been working on are with botanicals. We've actually partnered with Cynthia Ryder and quite a few folks in our botanical safety efforts to understand ginkgo biloba extracts. We know that ginkgo biloba can actually lead to increased liver weights in rats, and there are some suggestions that happens in humans as well. And these sandwich culture hepatocyte models actually do a really nice job of mimicking hepatic receptor activation through nuclear receptors and the aerohydrocarbon receptor to model chemical responses. And we were able to effectively show that looking at a series of different lots of ginkgo biloba extract, that just looking at cytochrome P450 induction in these more organotypic models enabled us to effectively discriminate molecule or mixtures that were inducing versus not inducing, and evaluate sufficient similarity of these by an evaluation of cell health, mRNA and enzymatic activity induction, and then, of course, linking constituents to the biological responses in these mixtures. And so I'm happy to talk with others about that kind of work. But we're doing not only developing these kinds of models, but we're actually applying them. And this was one example. There are several other examples that I would just quickly highlight that are ongoing. So PFAS, or perfluorinated alkyl substances, and aqueous film-forming foams that contain perfluorinated alkyl substances are also environmentally a very concerning topic right now. And we're actually evaluating these in various in vitro models of liver, including these HepaRG cells, which in many ways replicate the hallmark, the hepatocyte functionality we see with primary human cells, such as in this case CAR translocation, which is really only modeled with these highly differentiated cultures of HepaRG cells and in liver and in primary human hepatocytes in these same types of culture configurations. And we see that AHR, CAR, and PXR functionality responds in a manner analogous to human hepatocytes, and their metabolic competence is on par with two-dimensional cultures of hepatocytes. So we view this model as a really nice one because it enables us to have a genetic platform that allows year-over-year screening in the same genetic background. Then we can build out donors as we get more nuanced and focused questions. We're also looking at polycyclic aromatic compounds, and we have a manuscript that's coming up on that, as well as a manuscript on PCBs. And so PCB 126 and 153 would be a couple of examples where we're applying these systems to try to better understand and contextualize these environmental chemicals to one another using these more organotypic culture models that are not only capable of modeling more complex biology, but they're also metabolically competent. And that enables you to not only assess the parent chemicals, but also metabolites that would come out of these. And so we're really excited about these new areas that are emerging. But we realize that those models, even though they've been quite effective in drug development and for our applications in the near term, we understand that there's a continuum of metabolic competence. And I mentioned earlier about that benchmark of metabolism. What we know is if you take these HepaRG cells that are really great cells and you put them in these culture configurations that resemble a proliferating cell culture model, they don't behave much better than our TOX21 cells. However, when you put them in two-dimensional cultures like a sandwich culture, you get much higher activity. And then what we've discovered very recently is our culture models in 3D spheroid configurations begin to achieve levels that are on par with the 25th to 50th percentile of primary human hepatocyte suspension. So now you have enough metabolic competence to begin to mimic better the dynamics of exposure in vitro that mimic the plasma exposure that one would see in vivo. So we're really excited about the potential of these 3D models. There's been a lot of explosion on it. And the rest of the talk I'm going to mix in looking at the 3D and the 2D HepaRG models as we begin to apply and qualify how we would use these methods. What's nice about these systems is, and I showed you earlier about that the zonal metabolism that you see in the liver, is that not only do we have a very high level of metabolic activity, but these spheroids actually are further inducible. So they're not just induced and have high metabolism, which is what you've often seen in the gene tox field, but they can further be induced by activators of AHR, CAR, or PXR, in a way that mimics the dynamic response that you see in the liver. So this is really one of the hallmarks of liver hepatocyte functionality, and the spheroids, in essence, have their cake and eat it too. They have metabolic competence, and then they're further inducible to begin to mimic the dynamics that you see in the human liver. And so we're really excited about these models. Not only are they differentiated in terms of their metabolism, but this is a slide, a confocal imaging of a biliary efflux transporter that demonstrates the localization of this efflux transporter, which is localized, again, on the canalicular domain. And what you're seeing here are little bile pockets or channels that you see forming. And this is a projection that's sort of adding the different fields together. But the idea is that these demonstrate, just like 2D cultures, but even better, that we don't have a cholestatic model, that these systems are actually forming bile acids and bile salts. They're trafficking them through active efflux transporters into these canalicular domains, and then that's being dumped out into the systemic media, which is also observed with the sandwich cultures, but in the 3D we see it much more extensively in these really beautiful images. And this was actually supported with classical histopathology imaging, where you can see MRP2 staining producing these little apical domains that came out when we sliced these spheroids in collaboration with Darlene Dixon at NTP Labs, as well as poly-CEA staining demonstrating evidence of these canalicular domains. We also saw the glycogen storage and an interesting phenotype where CK19, which is a marker for laryngeocyte epithelial cells, we're actually seeing evidence that they're forming after 21 days in culture, this sort of exoskeleton on the outside of the spheres, and it was really an interesting phenotype. Now, in terms of the efflux transport, we actually show with live cell choleolysofluorescein imaging. This is a substrate for MRP2 and BSEP, the bile salt export pump, that these dyes will actually stay in these bile pockets, so not only from an immunohistochemistry type staining, but also from live cell imaging. You can see a very nice localization there, further demonstrating the utility of these models to polarize and adapt and mimic the dynamics of bile acid localization. But you also see the CK19 periphery is not only supported with these HEPA-RG spheroids, but also is seen in primary human hepatocytes when they're co-cultured with non-parenchymal cells. And you see the same CK19 positive border. And so we're excited that this seems to be a common feature for spheroids, and it's showing that our HEPA-RG spheroids are in fact behaving very similar to primary human hepatocytes in these same culture configurations. And what we really like most about this system, as we mentioned, we have to cover lots of chemicals, is the fact that we can put them in 3D foil plates. And we can do it in a manner that's much more efficient in the use of the cell numbers and is highly reproducible across the plate. And I just want to thank and acknowledge again Srinivasa Ramagari, who's now staff scientist with our program. He's done an amazing job in pushing these forward in the lab, and we're really excited about the future with these models. One of the examples that we've looked at to sort of demonstrate the metabolic competence of these systems is to look at the response to the metabolically activated compound aflatoxin B1. You can see here that compared to 2D cultures, as 3D cultures are used or repeated exposure with 3D cultures are used, you get this sort of less shift in the relative sensitivity to become more sensitive to toxic response. And this inhibition, toxicity response, the cytotoxicity response, is actually inhibited by the PAN-P450 inhibitor one aminobenzotriazole. And so this demonstrates that there's a metabolically activated component going on with this exposure, and we've seen this with several other examples that I'll show later. Also, one of the ways that we wanted to qualify these models is to try to use a sort of pharmaceutical approach to say, well, we have drug analogs that we know are liver injury chemicals, and we have ones that we know are similar in structure analogs, but yet have quite different clinical outcomes. And so we know from clinical exposures that trofloxacin and troglitazone were withdrawn from the market because of liver toxicity, mostly considered idiosyncratic, but still quite prevalent. And what we found is also true is that there are analogs like levofloxacin and rosiglitazone that weren't withdrawn from the market and had less toxicity. And just using these simple spheroid models with repeated exposure begins to distinguish trofloxacin from levofloxacin and troglitazone from rosiglitazone just using a simple cytotox assay. So you might imagine using this approach with a repeated exposure and looking at sort of the LD50 with these kinds of systems would be a first pass way to look for liver toxicity across hundreds and thousands of chemicals as you think through screening strategies to better understand and sort of pave a path forward for more sophisticated molecular analysis. One of the things that we've been sort of struggling with in our program, though, is trying to understand what's so special about 3D cultures, and in particular these spheroids. And one of the things that we have been focusing on was generating a transcriptomics platform. And so what we decided to do was take an opportunity not only to qualify these 3D spheroid models for liver injury predictions, and so we identified a set of 24 chemicals, some which were and were not associated with liver injury, some of which were associated with specific hepatic receptor activation features. Some were drug analog comparisons, like the ones I mentioned earlier, and then negatives, ones that are typically not associated with liver injury. And we asked the question, if we integrate cell morphology, cytotoxicity, and high-throughput transcriptomics using our S1500-plus sentinel gene set, that's a highly focused way to efficiently interrogate the transcriptome without having to do the whole transcriptome, could we develop a screening platform that enabled us to characterize these models and understand their relative potential for toxicological modeling, hopefully develop paradigms to actually build out predictive model systems. And so we've moved forward with that quite a bit. Our 3D spheroids actually effectively were able to mimic both in terms of individual gene as well as pathway levels, the reference pathways associated with exposure to rifampicin and phenobarbital. These are activators of the PEC pregnan X receptor, PXR, as well as the constitutive androstenedione receptor, PAR. And both untargeted data analysis for pathways as well as these individual genes just confirm that the system's working. And again, support previous experiments we've done with some more conventional TACMAN type qPCR assay to show that these models are capable of reflecting liver-like and hepatocyte-like function analogous to the in vivo situation. We also found that when we looked at the two-dimensional and the proliferated cultures, which we know have different levels of metabolic competence, as I mentioned earlier, when we drill down to individual genes, we actually see things that make sense. CYP1A1, for example, is known to be a fetal form. It's much higher expressed in fetal liver than it is adult liver. And we actually see that here, that the proliferated HIPRG, which reflect a less differentiated state, had higher levels of CYP1A1 metabolism than the differentiated cultures. And they both were responsive to activation by the AH receptor activator omeprazole. What's also encouraging from these data was that we know that omeprazole is metabolized to a sulfone metabolite, and that metabolite is actually an activator of the prenin X receptor, and that will further induce CYP3A4. And so we see the opposite relative comparison when we look at proliferated versus 2D with the CYP3A induction. In fact, we see much better response with the more mature cultures for CYP3A4 induction. And this is consistent with a higher propensity for this to metabolically activate and for a more efficient response of the receptor pathway to function. So not only can you look at these transcriptomic data at a broad level and a sort of unsupervised pathway type level, but you can also drill down to individual genes that are highly diagnostic of particular risk factors such as hepatic receptor activation. So we're really encouraged by the preliminary work with this. We've also turned to benchmark dose analysis, or what we call in vitro benchmark concentration analysis, where you see an individual curve like the ones you saw earlier that's shown here, and they accumulate these curves at different points of departure. So the benchmark concentration would be the concentration at which we cross the threshold, the benchmark response. And so in this particular culture, that would be shown here. And so that concentration for each gene that produces a statistically significant trend of dose response like this would get a circle like the one shown here. So CYP3A4, for example, for this particular exposure with rifampicin would show up at this circle. And you just accumulate those in an integer-type type fashion and across the concentration gradient. So you begin to be able to contextualize responses that you see in this range that might be more related to pregnant X receptor activation relative to therapeutic plasma concentrations. And then even higher concentrations where you're starting to get lots of bad things happening, like ER stress and oxidative stress, apoptosis. And so as you think about it, it's almost a way to resolve the relative potency of biological response. And in these lower regions, we're seeing responses that are more target-specific. And as you get to higher concentrations and you sort of see this hockey stick-type feature, you begin to see things that would be more classically off-target or stress or death kind of pathways. And so this idea of using this model relative to therapeutic concentrations is a way to begin to understand and predict human response. And we're doing that with pharmaceutical chemicals and then later extending that to environmental chemicals. So this 24 chemical set that we have, you see the full data set for one of the independent runs we ran. We ran three independent runs for the two-dimensional differentiated HEPA-RG. And what you see here is sort of the hockey sticks that formed, and most of these that produce large numbers of benchmark concentrations are liver injury chemicals, whereas the chemicals that were generally safe or much less likely to cause liver toxicity didn't produce responses or produce them at very high concentrations relatively. We were also excited to see that the relative potency at which you crossed a threshold that was three standard deviations above the negative liver injury chemicals that we had actually sort of bore out the relative ranking of therapeutic toxicity we see amongst these chemicals, as well as environmental chemicals like benzoylpyrine and aflatoxin that were by far the most potent. So that was really encouraging to see, and we've actually tabulated that in the manuscript you see here. You can get a better sense of that. We did have a couple of failures here, valproic acid being one of the big ones that I was surprised about, as well as dimethylnitrosamine. Now, dimethylnitrosamine turned out that even though it's Henry's law is relatively reasonable for in vitro exposures, its actual volatility is quite high. And so this was a real challenge for us, and it being semi-volatile, it's probably why that didn't work. But the valproic acid should have worked, and I'll show you some data with 3D in just a moment to talk about that further. But in terms of trovafloxacin and levofloxacin, I mentioned earlier about the cytotoxicity differences. When we look at the transcriptomics data, it's night and day. Trovafloxacin produces a huge number of benchmark concentrations, and relative to the therapeutic exposure concentrations that we know are observed in humans, you would see this well below the concentrations where humans were exposed. And it makes sense that this would have been withdrawn from the market for liver toxicity. Even if it's idiosyncratic, you still could use this type of assessment to compare these molecules and think about their off-target effects and essentially use this approach for environmental chemicals to be able to bend them. In the pathways that we saw, lots of bad pathways happening, stress and death pathways. With trovafloxacin, levofloxacin produced no pathways in the same type of analysis. Also, we hope to use more examples of therapeutic target identification. In this case, we're using troglitazone versus rosiglitazone. We know they activate the proxyline proliferator activated receptor gamma. And what we saw in trovafloxacin was three exposures producing benchmark concentrations for the PPAR gamma pathway in this sort of 100 to 200 nanomolar range, whereas with rosiglitazone, we saw them much more right shifted. And this was a bit shocking to us when we consider the fact that troglitazone is actually capable of a much less potent activator of PPAR gamma than rosiglitazone. 550 nanomolar versus 18 nanomolar. But it turns out this approach using a pathway-based method that relies on displaying the median BMD or BMC within a gene set actually conflates genes that have been historically annotated together and may in fact not fully reflect the tissue-specific responses. But instead of looking at all the genes in the PPAR gamma pathway, just look at fatty acid binding protein 4 and adiponectin, they in fact perfectly match the relative potencies of pirfenidone versus rosiglitazone that we would see in a gene reporter assay. But these other genes that are firing much higher concentrations are shifting the median BMD. And so I think as we think through how we're going to define metrics from these kinds of analyses, we're going to better define the sentinel pathways with reference chemicals and be able to use that towards more translationally predictive and informative assays. A couple more examples in this data set, and I'll wrap up. The first example is cyclophosphamide. We know this is a metabolically activated chemotherapeutic. It really didn't do a whole lot in the 2D cultures. We saw a couple of hundred genes that were changed. You can see the data down here in the 2D versus the proliferated. So proliferated HepRG had virtually no response. Two-dimensional HepRG had quite a bit of response, but in comparison to our most recent 3D data, it's just quite small. And what this says to us is that for chemicals requiring metabolic activation, and that would include things like polycyclic aromatic compounds as we think about environmental exposure, these 3D models may be far superior in being able to mimic both parent chemical and metabolite formation responses. And when we look at the pathways that were observed here, we see things that make sense: lipid hydroxylation, P450 metabolism, cell cycle, reactive oxygen species, DNA damage, hypoxia. All these things are found in humans when they're taking cyclophosphamide. So deciphering how these pathways relate to humans, building confidence with imaging systems in our spheroid models and our 2D models that can better diagnose those kinds of features, and then applying that to environmental chemicals is really the strategy that we're going forward with here. Another example, valproic acid. Again, I mentioned earlier that this was a compound that we missed in our original exposures, and you see that data down here. The proliferated and 2D cultures just produced a handful of genes, and given that this was a idiosyncratic liver injury compound, this was a big failure. But 3D cultures just blew up with activity, and when you look at the composition of those genes, fatty acid metabolism, biosynthesis, mitochondrial function, GABA receptor, even though these are liver cells, liver does have neurons of some sort and their GABA receptor, and you see evidence that even though it's not behaving neurologically, there's evidence that genes related to that are starting to respond, and that may be a sentinel for other tissues if we think about that. And then as you get to higher concentrations, you start to get stress and death pathways that are emerging. We know for a fact that hyperammonianemia is one of the clinical markers of valproic acid toxicity, and seeing urea cycle popping up at the higher levels is really confirmative that we're heading down the right path. So we're really excited about this. We're going to dig into this further and look at the metabolism pathways and look at the other ways that these 3D spheroids are really uniquely modeling this type of toxicity. It's even better. It allows us to screen chemicals and look at that type of response. Also, in thinking about philosophically what is so special about 3D, Srini in our group really did a nice analysis here where he showed that one of the hallmarks is sort of distinguishing so far 3D cultures from 2D and the fact that the 3D seemed to be enriched for a given pathway. So P53 signaling, let's say it has 500 genes that are associated with it, and in the S1500 data, gene set, we may have 100 of those. Well, 3D cultures identified 39 of them that were being identified and mapped to P53 signaling, whereas only 14 genes were seen in 2D and proliferated configurations. And so we're seeing that across the board. For pathways, we're seeing an improved enrichment of genes within a particular pathway. So it's beginning to behave more like the classical tissue. And Srini always likes me to point out that pancreatic adenocarcinoma was also identified with benzalkylpyrene exposure here in this particular data set, and that's been shown for sure in dietary intake of heterocyclic amines and benzalkylpyrene for pancreatic cancer. So there are really a lot of opportunities and challenges with spheroids, and I think the primary thing that we're excited about is to be able to bridge the gap of high-throughput screening with enhanced longevity and ability to model phenotypes. We know for a fact people are publishing studies that look at liver fibrosis, steatosis, cholestasis. A variety of liver functional assays are being defined with these kinds of systems. And so their long-term duration allows you not only to mimic the molecular initiating events, but progressions down towards pathology, and even be able to take those away to understand better that the latent responses that would be left behind after a chemical exposure versus an adaptive response. And there's a lot of exciting opportunities as we image these better and build that confidence in partnership with our pathology branch. But the big challenges, you know, we're changing culture media without liquid handling, and that's always a challenge. Imaging the spheroids can be a bit of a challenge. Bit of extra time and some sophisticated machinery to be able to screen chemicals for that. We don't really understand well enough how these spheroids mature. We can continue to work on that. And we also know we're going to have challenges related to allometric scaling. The liver is a very large organ. And as we think about mimicking the biomass considerations, we need to proportionally control the volumes of liquid and cell numbers to better mimic those dynamics of internal exposure. And then finally, just optimizing the culture conditions. So as we go forward in the program, we have a few major projects that I wanted to just highlight that are pushing towards expanding and extending these efforts. And these are available on the TOC21 website as well. A cross-partner project number 5 in particular is working to build a reference database with about 300 pharmaceuticals and chemicals that are highly established to hit a particular target, and we're going to build out a transcriptomic reference data set as reference chemicals where we know we have particular biological targets that enables us to contextualize unknown chemicals. And this will be made publicly available to everyone, so they'll be able to take their favorite chemical and run gene expression assay with next-gen sequencing type methods and be able to sort of frame out their chemical by defining signatures of transcriptomic response to these reference chemicals and then enabling evaluation of unknowns. And then NTP is also, as I mentioned earlier, investing in this parallelogram type mindset, and so we've developed rat primary hepatocytes that I didn't have time to talk about today. We've got efforts going on. Will Gwynn and Mike DeVito previously have led efforts and just published work in short-term 5-day in vivo studies in rats. To identify transcriptomic signatures that enable us to estimate the point of departure for any tissue, any pathology, and that work is very promising. And so we're building the in vitro components of this and linking that back with our established NTP and historical data on long-term studies, including carcinogenicity studies, that build out this parallelogram. And then finally, just partnering again with our histopathology and clinical pathology partners to be able to model both liver and newer efforts with kidney. And I know I've taken a little bit more time than I intended, but I do want to make sure to just thank you know, all the people in our program. It's very much always a collaborative effort. And you see the names here. I've mentioned Srini many times. Caitlin Laverick is also a postdoc working in our group. Scott Auerbach in particular has been really instrumental in the transcriptomics, as well as Rick Paulus, who's now retired. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Excellent. Thanks so much for the great presentation, Steve. Lots of questions are coming in, so I'm going to do my best to try to categorize them so they kind of make sense in terms of the themes that they're covering. One of the questions that we had was, have you used normal human organ-specific adult stem cells to generate your liver spheroids or mark them with OCT4A and lack of connexin gene expression? And then there's a second part of this question, and the question is have you been able to compare some of the human 3D spheroid 3D models?
Yes, so I could answer both of those. So I think I'll answer the second one first. We actually have, Caitlin has been working on primary human hepatocyte spheroids and has some really nice work. In fact, she just won a FAIR award on that the last couple of days. So she's expanding the number of donor preparations beyond HepRG so that we can look at many donors. And she included in that neonatal hepatocytes. And so that enables us to begin to look at the developmental susceptibilities, especially given the established metabolic deficiencies of young liver and exposing neonatal situations to adult levels of chemicals that are severely impaired in metabolism. So we're definitely expanding out into the human primary hepatocyte side. We see similar trends so far in the data we've been able to produce with HepRG versus hepatocytes. And so we see the HepRG as a screening model year over year. And we see the primary hepatocytes beginning to push the envelope towards understanding diversity, or at least susceptibility and disease risk as we move towards diversity. About the first question, one of the main reasons that people use liver models derived from a human liver donor, and those can be both resected tissue as well as a whole liver tissue, is because of the severe challenges in taking stem cells and getting them to differentiate in vitro in a manner that mimics adult hepatocyte functionality. You can get them to do certain things. They'll make biopockets. They will start to move towards adult state, but typically every study I've seen today, whether it's using 2D or 3D models to try to move stem cells into a mature hepatocyte functionality, is that they achieve a fetal form of liver function, a hepatocyte function. So they're really not, until at this point, there's a chasm to be able to get the stem cell models into behaving like primary hepatocytes in metabolism, hepatic receptor function, transporter function. These are all going to be hallmarks that have to be achieved with stem cells before we can really start to apply those. But eventually, I think we'll get there.
Thank you. Another question, specifically a question about one of your slides. So the slide that where you showed the benchmark concentrations analysis, the question was, could some of the early responses, so the lower concentration, be for compensatory or adaptive mechanism?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we have this idea that a highly specific pharmaceutical agent is hitting the target and nothing else. And in fact, that may be true for some chemicals, and for others it won't. So it is certain that at the lower concentration ranges, you know, we're expecting to have an enriched signature for direct acting, highly potent effects that would, in many cases, drive a risk assessment. So we're expecting that. But we also believe as you go to higher concentrations, you begin to get a mixture of targeted and off-target effects. And we're hopeful that we can use high-resolution concentration and time response to begin to really resolve those processes sufficiently that enables us to better understand adaptive biological responses like eating food versus responses that are truly toxic. But it absolutely will be a mixture of those things, with some chemicals having very little activity until they cause, you know, acute cytotoxicity and death, whereas other chemicals might hit a receptor, and we've seen some examples of that. Dioxin will be an example like that. And then you can go to incredibly high concentrations and you still don't kill human hepatocytes, but you hit dioxin at 0.01 animal. And so we'll definitely see gradients of that as we look across chemical space.
Thank you. I'm going to see if I can do my best to fit in two more questions. The first one is, how can you use the results from these assays to be able to expand them to human studies? So specifically thinking about how exposures that have really short half-life that you don't necessarily pick them up right away, and relating that with the progression of pathology. So can you use what the assays you're using to be able to translate that to some of the human population studies and picking up specific markers there?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. As we think about, you know, which windows of time are going to be most toxicologically relevant, it's going to be a mixture. You're going to have things like estrogen receptor and estradiol. The half-life of estradiol in the in vivo situation may be 20, 30 minutes when you get that bolus of response and it's gone. And then there's sort of this sort of ping pong effect where you hit the receptor, there's clearly a biological response, but then the chemical's gone. And so, yes, we're absolutely going to have to identify what those windows of interpretable, meaningful biological response are, and we expect that they'll be you know, the early burst of responses. As you look at gene expression, you see, you oftentimes see a burst of responses, and then there's this sort of adaptive recovery from that. And what we need to do in these qualifying studies is to use time to help us understand what is an adaptive response that they, that the system can deal with versus something that sends it down a new trajectory. And using that feature to distinguish what is going to be toxic from something that might be adaptive. And I think ultimately the challenge there is just to tune our systems and look at them well enough that we understand the context of use and which windows to look at for interpreting which pieces of an adverse outcome pathway. But it's absolutely certain that there are going to be acute responses that are going to be missed if you wait until later time points to look at them. And acute response and responses that happen acutely that sort of persist and look adaptive that can really start to amplify over time. And hopefully these models have a sufficient longevity that will begin to tease those things out and even look for things as complicated as you know, cellular transformation and maybe even you know, early markers of cancer. That's the hope anyway, is that how can we use chemicals in these systems to understand that?
Absolutely. And then one last question before we move on to the second speaker today. And that's related to what you have shown on this slide. So it ties in. It's good that you have this slide here. What you've showed is mostly gene expression as your readout for the biological response. Does this cover enough? So there's a lot of other omic strategies being used out there, such as proteomics and metabolomics. We're just wondering why you haven't looked to that. Do you think gene expression is capturing enough?
No, I don't think it is. I think so there's very practical considerations for why we started here, and that's because we had already begun investing in sort of identifying higher throughput methods to do transcriptomics, and there was opportunity. I think the second thing is it's a more mature technological approach that has a much more established connection between interpretation and molecular features. So we definitely know that the gene expression is John Bucher told me one time, it's what the cells want to do, right? So it's telling us a piece of the puzzle, but it's absolutely not the puzzle. The truth is always going to be the pathology, right? So that the clinical chemistry, clinical pathology markers, the histopathology markers are when we can demonstrate clear toxicity. And we're going to need those functional endpoints that build a weight of evidence. And it doesn't have to be this 20-year research project. These omics technologies are getting good enough, and the transcriptomics being the most mature, that we can figure out how to efficiently survey sentinel sets of genes but a particular model system. And particular protein targets within a model system and particular subsets of metabolites that are diagnostic within a model system and integrating that in a relatively rapid fashion with imaging technologies, and all of a sudden you've got a paradigm for being able to integrate these types of data together into a more diagnostic, a more interpretable representation of the progression towards adversity.
All right, excellent. So, Steve, we hope that you'll be able to stay on for the duration of the webinar. If anybody else has any questions for Steve, please don't hesitate to put it through the Q&A pod. If we don't get time to ask it at the end of the webinar, we'll be sure to pass it along personally to Steve. So thanks again, Steve, and please stay on the line. All right, thank you. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Manish Arora. Dr. Arora is a professor and vice chairman of environmental medicine and public health at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York. After training as a dentist in India, he received his master's and PhD from Australia, and his postdoctoral fellowship training was from Harvard School of Public Health. He is known for his work on biomarkers that utilize human deciduous and permanent teeth to recognize the timing of exposure to various harmful chemicals and essential nutrients, and biological response to those environmental factors. His methods are being applied to the study of outcomes that are of national health priorities, including autism, schizophrenia, and Lou Gehrig's disease. Aurora has also undertaken research on the intersection of oral system and systemic health with the environment and is currently contributing to the emerging field of environmental biodynamics. And you guys are in for a nice treat with his presentation. His work is supported by grants from the NIH, including the New Innovator Award from NIH Director's Office and the River Grant from the NIEHS. For his research contribution, he was the recipient of a U.S. Presidential Early Career Award for Scientist and Engineer from the Office of President Barack Obama. Manish is an immigrant to the United States of America. So Manish, thank you so much for joining us, and I am going to turn this over to you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Just a quick sound check if that you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Thank you. So thank you for this opportunity. It's a real privilege to share some of my team's work with you, and I want to start off by acknowledging Drs. Paul Curtin, Christine Austin, and Austin Curtin, who have done much of the work that I'll be presenting and are key members of my team. Before I start with the scientific part of the presentation, I just want to quickly resonate what another immigrant scientist had once said, that the more I feel American, the more grateful I am to all that this country has done for me, the more I want to support all those who are out there leading the peaceful protest to bring about this positive change for all of us. Thank you for letting me say that, and now on to some science. So the underlying theme here of the seminar series deals with latency. And what are we tackling here? Often we are faced with a condition that manifests at later stages of life. For example, here in this graphic, we can see that the disease was detected quite late in adulthood. But we suspect often that the origins are much earlier in life, could even be at the fetal stage or early childhood. So one of the key components of this challenge of uncovering or tackling latency is this temporal separation or time. I was very fortunate that about 4 to 5 years ago, I won this grant called the New Innovator Award. It's a unique grant that allowed me to work on topics of interest without a specific aim space. So it gave me the freedom to study many different avenues. And one aspect that I picked was to understand the very concept of time, its physical nature. I'm going to share two attributes of time today that I find very interesting and are relevant to this talk, but there are many others. So the first one is this. If you all think of yourself at an individual or an organism level, you'll realize that if you looked at yourself 5 years ago and you look at yourself today, you look different. You have changed. But this change isn't just at an individual level. If someone was to look at your tissues, then your tissues are changing as well. And this change exists right down to our fundamental components. For example, the telomere lengths on your DNA are now shorter. So even at that level, you're changing. And that's where we realize that we perceive time through its entanglement with change. And as we take this logic to a lower level of spatial organization, we realize something really amazing, at least it's really amazing to me. That once you start looking at atoms and subatomic particles, the calcium in your bones and in your teeth, about 5 years ago, it looked the same as it looks today. The atom and the subatomic particles are not changing. And that's why equations that describe their behavior have no variable for time. But yet we all are made up of these atoms and we all perceive time. So time is an emergent property that arises from the interaction of atoms and ions that themselves do not perceive time. So once we are seeing this emergent property, most of us will visualize it like this. Here is a simple clock, and the face of the clock has 12 numbers because I'm only showing the hours. And again, I think many of us take it for granted, but don't ask this question. What are the different components of this representation of time? I'm only going to share two. So I'm going to take these 12 numbers that represent the hours on a 12-hour clock and lay them down horizontally. And to show that there are two aspects or two attributes of time, I'm going to corrupt one attribute in each sequence of these numbers. In the first one, what you see is the numbers still go from 1 to 12, but there is a loss of sequential order. In the second set of numbers, the order is preserved, but the spacing between them has been corrupted, or there are uneven intervals. My point here is that at a very simple conceptualization of time, we can break it into its sequential order and the intervals between the different measurements we take. Now, for much of my work on the tooth biomarker, I was focusing on the intervals. I wanted to get the calendar time right. So about 4 years ago, it was quite a eureka moment for my team when we realized that, to be honest, the sequential order often gives us more information than the intervals. And in a couple of slides, I'm going to show you how that realization translates to something that's clinically applicable. Now, these thought processes, these kinds of discussions and realizations about the nature of time led us to ask for the creation of a new field called environmental biodynamics. And we're not the only ones. There's a group of collaborators in Italy and Spain and several others in the US who are contributing to this. But to convey the major difference between environmental biodynamics and what we currently do through the use of, let's say, omic sciences, I want to give you this very simple comparison. Our omic sciences, whether you're studying toxic chemicals or whether you're looking at gene expression or you're looking at essential nutrients or even social factors such as social stress, we often measure it with some realization of intensity or concentration or presence or absence. But in environmental biodynamics, we look at it differently. We start measuring the process behind what we are seeing. We measure it in terms of orbits and trajectories, and later in the real data that I will share with you, I will give you some quantitative measures of what I mean by orbits and trajectories. But for now, you can visualize it as the orbit of a planet around its sun. We don't ask how much or whether it's high or low, but we still see it, and we can quantify it in terms of its simplicity or its complexity. So now, I'll ask Sarah to please switch to this video that I had sent. Thank you very much. Okay, so what I'm showing here is an orbit of calcium metabolism that lasts 10 years of a person's life, starting around birth to up to about 10 years of age. We took 500 sequential measures. That's like taking a blood sample every week. But we did all of this from a single sample of a tooth. Because there are growth rings in teeth, we could map up to 10 years of this person's calcium metabolism. And what you're seeing here is a graph that shows you what I had discussed or mentioned earlier, that calcium metabolism has an orbit. What you see this little black dot doing is that it's representing or showing the motion of calcium through phase space, very much like how our planet moves around the sun. And there are two aspects to this movement. You can see the little black dot moving around itself, the way our planet revolves on its axis, but it's also following a larger trajectory throughout the whole graph space, which is like our planet moving on its orbit around the sun. And this is how environmental biodynamics visualizes things such as metabolism or even exposure. We don't measure in terms of concentrations as such. We measure it in terms of time. So Sarah, thank you again, and if we can go back to the talk. Okay, great. So we're back at slide 8, and I'll move forward. All right. So how do we use this to address the main question underlying latency? Like I showed in one of the very early images, if you detect disease much later in life, but you suspect that the critical windows exist in fetal life or early childhood, then it's very hard to set up prospective cohort studies. or conditions that I'll show, one of them, Lou Gehrig's disease, it would require millions of people over 5 decades in a prospective cohort, something that we logistically cannot do. In a better or more achievable study design, we would have a case control study, a well-designed one, where we would recruit cases, match them with population-based controls, then go back in time and look at exposure during those critical windows. But this is not easily done. You could ask yourself this very simple question. What were you exposed to at birth or in early childhood? Now, none of us is carrying a detailed set of data on what our exposure was. We could rely on some cruder measures and ask our parents if there was a smoker in the house, but we certainly couldn't measure the concentration of cotinae or the various other contaminants in smoke that actually entered our body. This is what environmental biodynamics and the underlying technology of using teeth and hair biomarkers allows us to do. And I'm going to show you some real data right after this. And so to convey what we can achieve through this, and I apologize for any background noise here, I will present studies that on conditions that occur at 2 stages of life. Autism spectrum disorder, which is detected around the age of 4 on average, and Lou Gehrig's disease, which is detected after the age of 50. So let's start with autism spectrum disorder. Now, most of us have a general sense of what autism spectrum disorder involves. It's a neurodevelopmental disorder, involves disruptions of behavior, language, socialization. We also know that its prevalence is increasing. Some of it is due to better diagnosis, but also there are concerns that of environmental risk factors. There are certainly genetic studies showing heritability. But it has reached a point where it's about 1 in 60 on average in the United States and in most other developed countries. If you look at any report on autism spectrum disorder, there was one recently by the American Association of Pediatricians. They all say, well, one area that is really lacking is early diagnosis. Currently, we diagnose autism on average around the age of 4 using entirely clinical measures. Why do we want to diagnose autism earlier? Well, in a very simple and graphic, the reason is that most of the phenotype of autism, such as language delay, sensory pathways, the critical windows of opportunity where we can bring about the most change are in the first year of life. And much of that neuroplasticity is closing up on us after the first year. So we're losing this opportunity. Therapies exist, but we are applying them too late. And this has been shown in some very elegantly done clinical trials that if you have early diagnosis and you introduce early intervention, you can have better outcomes. So early diagnosis becomes a crucial component for autism spectrum disorder. I'm going to show you a study that was done in 4 clinical sites in 3 different countries, and we recently, and we still are publishing data from it. But I also want to mention the financial conflict of interest here, that Mount Sinai has submitted some patents on some of the technologies and some of the data that I will share with you. Excuse me. Our discovery population was in Sweden. Now, autism is a heritable condition. Estimates range from somewhere around 50% to over 90%. We wanted to leverage a twin design. As a subset of the Swedish twin registry, we had participants, even monozygotic twins, who were discordant for autism. We found something very interesting here. So we wanted to replicate this. And we replicated it in 3 different locations, which is unusual, but we wanted to be sure because our findings were quite surprising. And so we replicated this in a prospective cohort in the UK, where participants were geographically related, and then replicated in New York, where the participants were all siblings. So not twins, but they still have some genetic relationship. And then a group in Texas was recruiting participants through social media, so completely unrelated individuals, not geographically or genetically. And as I mentioned before, the data and the biomarkers that we use are teeth and hair. And the reason we use them is because they have these incremental markings, like growth rings in trees. So we can get exposure timing. We can measure the temporal dynamics of exposure and metabolism. So environmental biodynamics and autism risk. As I mentioned in an earlier slide, we're not measuring concentration here. We're measuring orbits and the complexity of orbits. So here on the y-axis, you will see that, excuse me again, that the controls in Sweden had more complex orbits. And that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. If something is crucial to our development, then we will reach an ideal level of complexity that maintains health, but it is not so complex that it costs too much energy. And what I'm showing here is data on multiple different elements. These include essential elements like zinc and copper that gave us the biggest signal here, but also some toxic elements like lead. You can see this clear difference between the autism cases and controls from Sweden. We saw the same difference in our New York study, also in the study based out of Texas, and the study based out of the UK. And when we pool all of this data together, as you can imagine, we get a statistically significant answer. But what's really interesting is that all the data that we're getting here, the biggest contributor to this separation between cases and controls, came from the prenatal period, specifically the third trimester and the first 6 months of life, so well before we clinically detect autism. Now, that work was done on teeth, and many of you would have now argued that, well, teeth shed, or baby teeth start shedding around 5 to 6 years of age. So they're a great research tool, but they cannot be worked towards a diagnostic biomarker because they shed after we can clinically detect the disease. And you're absolutely right. We use teeth because they help us discover pathways that are relevant. However, hair we can collect at any time, and many children are born with hair, and some will have hair within the first 6 months of life. And what we are showing here is a linear discrimination plot. Essentially, think of it like a PCA plot. And what we see here are these orange dots that show us where, where we have the autism cluster. The green dots are the ADHD cluster. The blue dots are those that have both autism and ADHD, and the pink dots are ones that are neurotypical. Now, the color arrives, or the data for the color is the clinical diagnosis, but as you see from this clustering, we don't need the color. Our algorithm tells us where individuals will fall. And behind each dot is a set of hundreds of biochemical features which we can rank by importance. So this works towards precision medicine, where at an individual level we can say which biochemical pathways are being disrupted and which are the set that are deriving most of this dysregulation. If we could prove causation, we are essentially saying which pathways are causing autism for this person versus another person. But what you will see here is sometimes we disagree with the clinician. For example, this pink dot here, the clinician has said that they are neurotypical, whereas our algorithm is saying, well, no, they fall under the ADHD cluster. When this happens, again, because we are trying to work towards this ideal of precision medicine, we can go back to the clinician and say, repeat your clinical assessment. And at the same time, we can collect another hair and repeat the laboratory analysis to figure out where the disagreement lies. Okay. So what this allows us to do, and we've done it both with teeth and with hair, is to achieve a classifier. This is not a diagnostic test yet. It has to go through more work and more refinement before we can say it is a diagnostic test. But right now, it's a classifier that works at around 95% accuracy, and we can start using it as soon as we can get hair. And we only need one strand of hair here, so it doesn't require a large collection of hair. And we don't need to pull the hair from the scalp, which can be painful. We just need to cut one strand of hair. With environmental biodynamics, and because its underlying concepts on time are central to all conditions that I can think of, at least, we can leverage those properties of the temporal dynamics that underlie diseases to not just study autism and ADHD. We can now overcome some of the latency problems at diseases that happen at different stages of life. For example, psychosis, we start seeing clinically its presentation during the teenage years and early 20s, whereas Lou Gehrig's disease, and I'll show some data on that, happens around the fifth decade of life or later. But we can see already how they're separating, how ADHD and autism are closer together in this biochemical feature space, whereas, as expected, psychosis and ALS are further apart. But again, as a reminder, behind each of these dots, we have a set of features for that individual person. This is not an average plot. It operates at an individual level. And now we have been working on conditions that might seem very far from CNS disorders, such as the rejection of a renal transplant or inflammatory bowel disease. And we're finding some interesting results that they're not biochemically, according to environmental biodynamics and the features we are measuring, they're not that far apart as one would imagine. Sometimes they have shared features with CNS disorders. So this allows us to understand the pathways underlying disease in a different way. That was about autism. And to be fair to other work that's happening around the world, people are trying other technologies, such as, you know, tracking eye movement, for example, or using MRIs. And so there are many other approaches people are trying, and I'm optimistic that they will lead to our ability to diagnose autism earlier and to initiate therapy earlier towards a positive outcome. But the challenge for a condition such as Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a motor neuron condition that presents around the fifth decade of life onwards, are much bigger. In the U.S., it's known as Lou Gehrig's disease after the famous baseball player, but the other famous person that at least I know of who was diagnosed with this condition was the late physicist Stephen Hawking. What I'm presenting to you is a study that is small. It's early days. It's a proof of concept study, which I could not have done without the collaboration with the University of Michigan with Dr. Figueroa Romero and Dr. Gautman, who are collecting all the clinical data for this work. ALS is a challenging condition, not only because of the latency aspect, but also because we don't know much. Most of the genetic studies have turned up empty. We barely can explain 10% of the etiology based on genetics. We suspect, as in many conditions, it's both genes and environment, and we suspect that it's early environmental factors. But until recently, we haven't had the tools to go back five decades and look at what's happening early in life. And that was the challenge that we wanted to attack here. So around the average age of 60 of our participants, we collected teeth and we started reconstructing at a weekly level the first 15 years of their lives. And the first stage of this study, we have measured essential elements, non-essential elements, and toxic metals. As I mentioned before, and this is a major limitation that everyone should recognize, it's a small study. We have 36 cases and 31 controls so far that were age and gender matched. These results were published just a few weeks ago in two separate papers. And here what I'm showing on the top graph in panel A here, is an analysis known as lagged weighted quantile sum regression that was developed by Dr. Chris Jennings, who's a statistician here at Mount Sinai. It looks at the entire metal exposure mixture, and it looks between or compares cases and control on the y-axis, and on the x-axis we have time from birth to about 15 years. And what we immediately start seeing is that there are case control differences as early as birth. When I look at this line dropping down, at least for me, and I don't have direct evidence for this, this is just a hunch at this moment, is that the body has a compensatory response. It's trying to balance the dysregulation. But when those compensatory forces fail, we start having other critical windows, and then we lose our ability to regulate those elements, and it sets us on this trajectory that four or five decades later will result in the clinical phenotype of Lou Gehrig's disease. Not only are these clinical, these critical windows of susceptibility, to me these are also critical windows of opportunity, where if we could fix the dysregulation here, there might be an opportunity to prevent or at least diminish this very fatal neurodegenerative disorder. And because we're picking up a biochemical pathway, these are not genes, there is something that we could potentially do. As a low-hanging fruit, our hope is to map some of these pathways to existing databases. For example, the TOX21 database or existing pharmaceutical databases, where we can see if there are ways to start working on these biochemical pathways. In the lower panel, panel B, what we see is the weighted association of each component of that mixture. So we have a bunch of elements here and toxic metals, and we can see which ones are really driving it. For example, early in life, they all seem to be dysregulated. But later in life, we can see that there are things such as copper that are carrying much of the weight. Earlier, there is the influence of zinc. And we can analyze this data in different ways. So in a second companion paper, we again said, well, it's a very small set of samples, but let's split it into two. Let's look at it as a training set and a validation set. Do we have a signal that can give us any level of acceptable accuracy to predict a disease that would happen 4 or 5 decades later? We ran different models. I'm showing you the one which was the most conservative or the lowest accuracy, which was about 80%, and which was this gradient boosting model. And then there was one that did much better, about 87% accuracy. So those were all the results slides. And I can see I'm almost out of time, so I'll move towards concluding. For me, the key underlying issue when we try to tackle disease latency is that so far we haven't really addressed time by understanding the very construct of time, its physical nature, the way physicists have done. We have relied very much on calendar time, and because of that, we have designed studies where we think that we are addressing temporal dynamics, such as prospective cohort studies, but as you can imagine, bringing back everybody, all your participants for a blood test or a urine test or clinical assessments every 6 months or 1 year is not the same as measuring environmental biodynamics. A common example I give is that, or the underlying reasoning behind this is that we need to understand the temporal dynamics and the scale at which that system operates. For example, if you're studying the flapping of the wings of a hummingbird, you don't want to take a photograph every hour. You would need a much finer time scale of experimentation there. On the other hand, if you want to study the evolution of the solar system, you don't need to take a picture every hour. That you run out of resources because that's overkill. So we don't need to bring our participants back every year or every 6 months based on logistics. We need to bring them back based on the dynamics of the system that we are studying and figure out what is the correct temporal scale at which those systems should be studied. Final is a common ask that I often end my talks with. If any of you are interested in collaborating and you have the ability to collect baby and adult teeth and hair, please feel free to reach out to me. I'm always looking for new conditions and new collaborators. a lot of people to thank, but again, I especially thank the NIEHS for the River Grant and many other sources of funding. As you can imagine, much of this or this type of work is not easily done through R01s, so the River scheme has been very beneficial, and before that it was the New Innovator scheme that allowed me so much freedom to pursue this work. I'll stop there. Thank you again for this opportunity, and I welcome any questions.
Many thanks, Manish. As you can imagine, we've got a lot of questions that have come through for this, and I'm going to do my best to try to ask them in a way that the theme, the thematic, are connected. But forgive me if that doesn't happen. So the first question is, referring to the video that you were showing with the calcium orbit, the question was, do some of the large directional perturbation in time represent an exposure or health change? Can it be attributed to things like growth spurts too?
Yes, that's a very good point. And In one of the papers that we just published a few weeks ago, it's in PLOS Computational Biology, we use that kind of data to form what is known as an attractor. So the underlying question here is, sure, we are all changing, but does that change have a shape that it indicates health versus a shape that indicates disease? And what we show using that attractor topography, it's almost like one of those maps that shows you the height of the geographical features you're studying, is that calcium metabolism, copper metabolism, almost the metabolism of many essential elements, doesn't follow the simple linear pattern at all. It goes through periods of very regular motion, and then it jumps out of this state of very good stability, enters a state of chaos, and then finds a new state of stability. So it turns out that rhythms are not the most important feature of our dynamics. In fact, there are periods in our development where everything becomes chaotic. And if that chaotic phase doesn't happen, we actually end up having ill health. Because the chaos between two states of very good stable dynamics is essential. We need to break down old systems to form new ones. And so absolutely, there are growth spurts. But again, a growth spurt is not a linear acceleration. It's a breakdown of a previous pattern and then the establishment of a new pattern. When we study ALS, sometimes we see that these new patterns don't form. The metabolism gets stuck in one stable state. Or other times, it just keeps bouncing from one chaotic state to another. So yes, the question was, or the logic behind the question was absolutely right.
Thank you. So now we have a couple questions that are specifically related to ALS. So I'll start asking those one by one with you. So were you able to determine any environmental contaminants that seem to be linked to autism and ALS?
So lead plays a role. We found some role for lithium as well. Again, I want to be clear that I'm not able to establish causality. That should be clear. But those were the environmental contaminants. However, what is encouraging to me is that zinc and copper played a big role in both of them. And the fact that, in medicine, we've been able to alter zinc-copper dynamics for other conditions, such as Wilson's disease, which is a copper dysregulation disorder from a genetic mutation, is encouraging. Because autism prevalence is increasing while lead exposure has been decreasing internationally. So there has to be more than just that. What we also found and what we can do, and I didn't show data on that, is we don't study one orbit at a time. We can study multiple orbits interacting, just like in our solar system. Earth's orbit is impacted by the orbit of other planets. So we are able to study the orbits of all these elements together. And often we find that it's not just one element that's impacting. Lead impacts zinc orbits, and copper impacts zinc orbits as well. So multiple orbits get disrupted. And we can prioritize which ones are the more important ones. And going back to the question directly, yes, zinc and copper play a role in both. And in terms of toxic elements, lead also was seen in several of the cohorts, as was lithium.
Thanks, Manish. So a question related to that, and this is, I appreciate that you said you can't determine causality, but this question comes from the observation that there's some current studies suggesting a relationship of mercury to ALS. But mercury wasn't seen in your metal mixture, didn't look to be examined. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. We did not accurately measure mercury. The levels are very low in teeth, and our method, laser ablation, ICP-MS, has poor detection limits for mercury in teeth. We are measuring mercury in hair, and there we do see some results, but for mercury we don't have good data yet. In our paper, we do include an animal model, a mutant mouse model for ALS. So I would refer readers to that for further insight into the mechanistic aspect.
And I think that this question, you're touching on the answer now, but the first part of it was to clarify, did you have baby teeth? And I think you just answered that. Yes, you did for the ALS study. The second question was, are you able to look at other elements? Other elements, so not just metal. Can you look at other things to see whether or not there's changes?
So we We do it in different ways. We can do it in a fully targeted format and get over 100 chemicals, organics, pesticides, phthalates, phenols, a bunch of them. We also do untargeted analysis where we get, 50,000 plus signatures, we call them features, and we map them to our database. So our database is over 1,000 chemicals. Excuse me, please. But then we have all these other levels of annotation and certainty from the other, 48,000 features. So we can do very wide screens. Here I'm presenting elements, and we are working on the organics data.
Thanks. And this next question is asking you whether or not you, for ALS again, since hair and teeth are available only postnatally, do you have a suggestion for potential prenatal markers?
Yes. So teeth are present, shed around 5 to 6 years of age for deciduous teeth, and adult teeth are even harder to get. For prenatal markers, that's why we rely on newborn hair or mother's pregnancy hair. But we must remember that there are other technologies out there. I'm presenting work on biomarkers, but there's, measures from the external environment, such as satellite remote sensing, which can measure air pollution going back to even before pregnancy. Having other direct fetal biomarkers, I don't know of many. Maybe you could use umbilical cord blood. That's been used several times, but that's a single snapshot. Imaging technologies such as MRIs, fetal MRIs, they're difficult, but more and more people are trying to do them. I don't know of a fetal biomarker that would provide timing, which would provide dynamics such as hair or teeth do.
Okay, thank you. This next question is just asking is this approach available for things like Parkinson's disease, lupus, and possibly diabetes?
Absolutely. So we're working on many, many conditions. Often I'm restricted based on what my collaborators have. As an exposure biologist, my interest is very much on better characterizing exposure, external and internal. But I welcome collaborations. If somebody has, we do have some Parkinson's samples coming in, but as you can imagine, there are few. These large studies are harder to do. So if somebody has samples on Parkinson or lupus or any other condition of public health priority, I'm more than happy to collaborate.
Excellent. Thank you. So these next couple of questions are really kind of looking at, in your presentation, you mentioned critical windows of opportunity, a chance to intervene. Do you have a hunch as to how this might work? Would it be a diet change, a behavior change, or both?
I suspect it would require more than just a diet change. The reason I say it is this. What we are measuring in many ways is the interface, or it's one of the interfaces between genes and the environment, which is metabolism, right? There could be other interfaces. But the problem with prior attempts to studying this interface has been we haven't really focused on time. Metabolism moves at the order of seconds, and we've been measuring it in prospective cohorts once a year. So we haven't been able to characterize it better. Even my group needs to work better to get it down to a few hours of temporal resolution. Now, I say that because just adding more in our diet might not fix the problem if your metabolism is broken. So let's consider another very dynamic system, which is music. Let's say two musicians are playing together, and once one starts playing poorly, the solution isn't to take the bad musician and raise their volume. It'll just make matters worse. So the solution isn't to just start giving more zinc if your zinc metabolism is broken. The solution is got very little to do with concentration or supplementation. It's got more to do with bringing the dynamics back in line. So the solution probably lies in the temporal dynamics. My group is very interested in working on this. So rather than just say, let's give you more zinc even though you can't metabolize and you end up ejecting most of it or something else, we want to figure out how to bypass those broken pathways or how to bolster those broken pathways. It's early days. We are more in the sort of thinking and reaching out to people who have databases that will allow us to map these pathways. We haven't got any real data yet.
No, absolutely. The next question is just appreciating that, you know, visualizations are very critical to communicating complex concepts. Do you have any insight on how we can better incorporate time into our current understanding of dose response?
I think that for me, that question has two parts. One is, I completely agree that because we have not focused on time, most of our data visualization tools are geared towards concentrations. I often look at bar charts and I feel like, nice way to present concentrations, but where's the time? You can't have, 500 bar charts, nobody can detect a pattern there, which is why I have to use a video, because I don't have access to any other tools. So we certainly need to focus on time. And a question that or a criticism of my own work before environmental biodynamics is that I treated time as a nuisance variable, right? You use it as a rate. You relinquish it to the denominator because you adjust it as a covariate, the visit number or the age of visit in your regression model. Time cannot be the nuisance variable. Time has to be the variable that we study. However, we can develop more complex graphs, and these days journals allow us videos so we can use simple dynamic graphs, but that still doesn't allow us to communicate it to the people who are most important, the population, our participants. They don't read bar graphs and dynamic graphs every day. And there we are working with a school of design here. It's called the Parsons School of Design, to develop tools that allow us to communicate briefly where you stand, both in terms of concentration, which we have been doing for decades now to tell people you're high, low, or where do you lie in comparison to a larger cohort, but also in terms of developmental timing. We're not there yet, but certainly it's very important, and we are working on that. One of the images I showed you earlier, which showed a pregnant woman on the left and an older male on the right, that is the beginnings of that, our ability to translate that to the general public. We are thinking of filling up each individual with different levels of a risk measure to show, well, okay, at birth your risk was high, but on a different graph your clinical symptoms were higher when you were in your 50s, things like that. So I don't have a very clear answer to the second part of the question, more a thought process.
Excellent. Well, many thanks to Steve and Manish for two really great presentations. I think both of those presentations really got us thinking broadly. So they were very, we had lots of great questions come in. So both of you should know that is a great indication on well put together and well presented presentations. And we do thank you for your time for doing that. So if you didn't get a chance to have your question answered, please do not hesitate to reach out to the speakers directly, and they will do their best to respond to your question. So thank you, everybody, for submitting those really thoughtful questions. So before we conclude today, I just wanted to make sure everybody is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we've assembled resources that were directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations today as they were given today. Also, in the related URL pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling this out. We do look at your comments, and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms based on your feedback. You can also request a confirmation email for the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly e-newsletter, Tech Direct, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for more information about upcoming sessions and archives. And you can also follow SRP on Twitter. Just as a reminder, too, we missed Dr. Stefano Monti, and just we will work with him to try to get his presentation up after the fact, so be looking for that as well. So just this is a slide to remind you to check out the archive. If you were not able to attend the first three sessions, which were really informative, we encourage you to do that. We wanted to let you know that the archives of those sessions are now available on CLUIN. If you enjoyed today's webinar but not had a chance to listen to the previous sessions, we encourage you to check out these archives. With that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question, as I said earlier, and we didn't get a chance to get to it, we'll pass these questions along to the presenters. If you have additional questions, which please don't be shy about it, you can also contact the presenters by email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. Finally, again, thank you to our presenters, Dr. Steve Ferguson and Dr. Manish Arora, for their time preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. We'd also like to wish Dr. Stefano Monti a speedy recovery and thank him for preparing an excellent presentation that we hope to hear soon. That concludes today's presentation, and we thank you all for your welcome to the Superfund Research Program Risky Learning Webinar Series on Exposures and Latent Disease Risk. This is Stefano's presentation from Season 4, Moving Forward. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. My name is Michelle Heacock, and I am a health scientist administrator with the NIHS Superfund Research Program. Unfortunately, Stefano Monti was in a bicycle accident the evening before the regular scheduled webinar on June 16th and was not able to present. He's okay now. He's here to do it for us today. And so we're recording this presentation so that you'll be able to hear it with the rest of the presentations in session 4. So Dr. Stefano Monti is a computational biologist and associate professor at Boston University in the computational biomedicine section of the Department of Medicine. He has a joint appointment in the bioinformatics program. Monti's laboratory integrates systems biology, machine learning, and bioinformatics approaches to investigate the molecular drivers of human disease with the goals of advancing prevention and care. Monti received his PhD in Intelligent Systems and Artificial Intelligence from the University of Pittsburgh and completed his training with a postdoctoral fellowship at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon. His doctoral and postdoctoral research focused on the development of machine learning and knowledge discovery methodologies with a particular emphasis on probabilistic reasoning and Bayesian approaches to modeling biomedical data. Since 2001, he has worked in the field of cancer genomics, first as a research scientist at the Whitehead Institute Center for Genome Research, and later as a computational biologist in the cancer program at the Broad Institute. Dr. Monti, I will now turn this over to you. Broad Institute.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Michelle. Good to be here, and thank you for having me here today. Yes, breaking my shoulder was not a case of the dog ate my homework. I have photos to prove it. But anyway, without further ado, let me go into the presentation, which is going to be an overview of the experimental and computational approaches we have developed and applied to model environmental chemicals and to predict their long-term adverse effect from short-term transcriptomic assays. And I will present, you can think of them as two case studies, which we like to call the Carcino Genome Project and the Adipo Genome Project. And I will summarize their goals, we'll present some of the results, and we'll discuss some of the challenges and lessons that we learned. So the work I describe today was initially motivated by our desire to model and predict chemical carcinogenicity. And we wanted to move away from a focus on cancer care and therapeutics and instead focus more on prevention. And to pursue this goal, we worked on an analytical and experimental framework that would make possible the prediction of the long-term cancer risk from chemical exposure using high-throughput transcriptomic assays, and computational approaches. Our initial focus on cancer was expanded to encompass a broader focus on the adverse effect of chemical exposure more in general, and I will present the case of metabolism-disrupting chemical, since we felt that the approach we were developing had general applicability. So the motivation for this work is probably largely superfluous for this audience, but let me make it nonetheless at least briefly. We're exposed daily to a cocktail of chemicals whose effect and potential synergistic effect are largely unknown. Chemicals like pesticides, industrial pollutants, air pollutants, and so forth. And here the punchline is that there are more than 85,000 commercial chemicals currently registered, and only less than 2% of those chemicals have been thoroughly systematically tested for their carcinogenicity, let alone, of course, testing their synergistic effect, since we're exposed to chemical mixtures in general, not single chemicals. So there are multiple approaches to evaluate the cancer risk of chemical exposure, and the first line of attack, let's say, is epidemiological studies. They're often used to raise the first alarm, but they are observational. Basically, they rely on observational data, and because of potential confounders, it can be difficult to establish causality. Then there are in vivo animal studies, such as the two-year rat bioassays, which until recently was considered sort of the gold standard for carcinogenicity testing, but its relevance to human carcinogenicity, plus its focus on cancer hazard rather than cancer risk, basically made them a little bit less appealing more recently, although I actually disagree with some of the other criticism. But in general, it is very time and resource consuming. Testing of a single chemical can take at least 2 years and an average of about $2 million and can go up to $4 million per chemical. And then there are in vitro studies based on human cell lines, well, cell lines, but of course, it makes sense to use human cell lines. These are potentially fast and inexpensive, but their biggest challenge, of course, is translating the in vitro results to in vivo relevance. And this is the approach that we, and the challenges that we try to tackle in our studies. So we set out to develop what I like to call a chemical carcinogenicity crystal ball, more formally a cancer risk prediction model, or even more carefully defined a cancer hazard prediction model, which will be capable of telling us quickly and accurately whether any chemical or emerging drug candidate can be cancer causing. And since we're scientists, we do not like black boxes giving us a yes or no answer. We'd also like to understand why. So as I said, one might argue that actually what we are developing is a cancer hazard prediction model, but we can leave that for the discussion if you want. So let me point out that the framework can be applied to actually predicting many different types of endpoints, adverse effects, which could be metabolism disruption, and I will discuss that case, or it could be toxicity, endocrine disruption, and so forth. So the experimental design of our studies, you will see that clearly betrays our machine learning background, because basically the study is set up as a generating a large training set from which to learn predictive models. And we started by generating a large compendium of expression profile from in vitro cell lines exposed to compounds properly stratified in carcinogen and non-carcinogens. And the generated transcriptomic data set becomes the input to our computational model building. Models hopefully capable of classifying unknown chemicals as carcinogen or non-carcinogens without are accurate, but also hopefully capable of providing insight into the chemical's modes of action and the pathways involved. Clearly, in order for this design to be feasible, we needed a cost-effective expression profiling assay, and that's why we relied on the Luminex 1000 platform developed by the Broad Institute in the context of the LINX initiative and the connectivity map. I will have a little bit more to say later. Or, for example, in the adipogenome project that I will discuss later, we actually use highly multiplexed RNA sequencing. Let me actually stress an important point here that we're using short-term in vitro assays to measure expression profile, to quantify expression levels. But we are using long-term phenotypes or carcinogenicity to train the models. So the in vivo validation, and I want to stress this, the in vivo validation is sort of built in the experimental design. And this is a point that I want to stress because actually it's important. And so the in vivo validation is built in the experimental design, at least as far as actually carcinogenicity prediction is concerned. As far as actually understanding the mechanism of action, that's a more difficult point, but prediction, we have basically the in vivo validation built in. So the central hypothesis, to summarize, is that basically long-term in vivo exposure phenotypes can be modeled, can be predicted by short-term in vitro transcriptomic assays. And this was really the central hypothesis of our studies. So can carcinogenicity be predicted from gene expression profile, short-term expression profiles? We got our first answer years ago from our studies based on rat-based short-term in vivo assays. And for this, we relied on publicly available transcriptomic data sets, the drug matrix and the TG gates, which were respectively US and Japanese initiative, which generated expression profiles from rat tissues after days to a maximum of 4 weeks of exposure to a large panel of chemicals, including known carcinogen and non-carcinogens. And so I cannot go into the details of the study here, but the take-home message was that basically, yes, long-term carcinogenicity can be predicted from short-term assays with an accuracy going between 77 and 83% based on a training set of about 130 chemicals. Based on our downsampling simulation, we showed that actually if we had a larger training set, if we had larger number of chemicals to train our model on, we could likely increase the accuracy of the model. And despite the fact that we're talking about short-term exposure, actually the gene expression profile captured important and known modes of action of carcinogenicity. So this was the another important point actually that actually really informed our subsequent effort was that carcinogenicity prediction is tissue specific. That is, if we want to predict, say, liver carcinogenicity, we need a liver model. Kidney carcinogenicity within a kidney model. If we want to predict breast carcinogenicity, we need a breast cancer model, and so on. And so with this in mind, with this feasibility study as sort completed, we embark in the next phase, which we like to call the carcinogenome project. And this was about using short-term assays with, in this case, in vitro models, that is cell lines, human cell lines. And so while we generated data sets for both liver and breast carcinogen, here we will focus on our liver carcinogenicity screen, which was the most extensive and best annotated, and also the one we published in EHP. We procured more than 300 chemicals, more or less evenly stratified between known carcinogen and non-carcinogens. And we used a transformed cell line, HepG2, exposed to the chemicals individually for 24 hours, multiple replicates and doses. And we used the Luminex 1000 platform that I mentioned before to measure gene expression. This assay directly measures or quantifies about 1,000 transcripts that are called the landmarks, and then extrapolates the level of the remaining transcript in the transcriptome. So this is a quick look, bird's eye view of the gene expression profile. This is about 3,000 profiles. The columns represent single profiles. The rows represent the 1,000 landmark, with color representing the Z-scores of the gene for that particular perturbation compared to the rest of the plate. And again, bright red means high expression, bright blue means low expression. And here we can see that there is a subset of profiles that have many genes strongly up or down regulated. On the other hand, other profiles don't show a strong transcriptional response. So we needed to quantify the extent of this global response, and we used what is called the transcriptional activity score, forget about the, which is basically sort of a ratio of the signal strength to the replica reproducibility. And so the higher the score, the stronger the transcriptional activity, which we can also think of as bioactivity. The measure is between 0 and 1, and 1 is, of course, maximum bioactivity. And so the first question we asked was, how does a chemical's bioactivity, as captured by the TAS, the transcriptional activity score, relate to carcinogenicity? And here we had some expected and not so expected results. And not so expected is good, because it reaches our knowledge, basically. The first result, which is kind of expected, is that bioactivity increases with dose, significantly so. Let me point out that actually each chemical was tested on 6 doses at increasing concentration. Then the second, maybe expected, maybe not so expected, was that dose response becomes steeper with higher bioactivity. And actually the third one, which was the least expected, at least for us, was that carcinogenicity is not, I repeat, is not associated with that bioactivity. That is, carcinogens did not manifest higher bioactivity than non-carcinogen. And I think this last results point an important take-home message, which is likely related to the distinction between acute and chronic exposure response. And basically, the take-home message is that a short-term chemical perturbation with minimal transcriptional response cannot be assumed to be safe. And we can discuss that more later. However, while high bioactivity was not associated with carcinogenicity, sufficient bioactivity was necessary for a chemical to be used for prediction of carcinogenicity. What do I mean by that? I'm showing you here, basically. I mean that sufficient transcriptional signal needs to be elicited from a chemical profile to be used fruitfully for prediction. And it's shown here, as you can see, basically, I'm showing you box plot, showing accuracy as we restrict the training set, the training and the testing, to sets of chemical with higher and higher bioactivity. For example, the left box plot shows the result based on all chemicals, while the rightmost box plot shows accuracy with profiles with TAS greater than 0.4, in which case the accuracy is 72%. And this is true also for genotoxicity, where basically when we restrict to high bioactive chemicals, basically we have an accuracy of 85%. So let me repeat this point because I think it's important. While high bioactivity was not associated with carcinogenicity, sufficient bioactivity was necessary for a chemical to be fruitfully used for carcinogenicity prediction. Okay, going beyond prediction of carcinogenicity, we were also interested to assess whether the assay would capture key feature of carcinogenicity. And despite the fact that we used the transformed cell line, HT2, a pathway-based analysis of the chemical highlighted important biological pathways. Upregulating carcinogens were pathways associated to immune response and inflammation, DNA repair, oxidative stress, and cell cycle progression, which are basically known hallmarks of carcinogenicity. And downregulating carcinogen were various metabolism-related pathways. And I think importantly, cell-cell organization and communication pathway, which probably reflect a loss of cell organization and possibly a loss of normal liver function. And, you know, if we go back to actually the previous set of presentation in this webinar series, the gene sets, or basically the hallmarks that were identified by gene expression, actually check most of the key characteristics of human carcinogens discussed by Dr. Smith. I only scratched the surface of the result produced by our data and by our analysis. So to make more of these results available, we developed a web-based portal that you can access at carcinogenome.org, where you can go and look for your favorite gene and chemical and explore its activity across chemicals or genes. Okay, so we're only halfway through the presentation. I hope I'm not running too late. Let us switch to talking about another adverse effect of chemical exposure. And in this case, I'm going to talk about metabolism disruption. And I'm going to talk about what I like to call the Adipogenome Project. Here we use transcriptional and also functional assays to study adipocyte dysregulation by environmental and therapeutic perturbations. And this requires a little bit of introduction. As you may or may not know, there are different types of adipocytes in our body which have different but complementary function. And when these work all properly, energy homeostasis or balance is maintained. So a metabolically healthy state reflects a tightly controlled balance between white and brown adipose tissues, with white tissues serving mainly as energy storage or fat storage, and brown adipose tissues being used for dispersing stored energy as heat, for thermogenesis, basically. And both also have a role in endocrine regulation. So this tightly controlled balance that I'm talking about is often disrupted or altered in obesity and may lead to metabolic diseases such as metabolic syndrome, insulin-resistant type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and can go as far as cancer. And it has also been shown that actually humans with greater potential to form what are called brown in white adipocytes, or BRIGHT, have a significantly lower risk of developing diabetes. And conversely, inducing a shift from brown to white adipogenesis can be deleterious. So why do we care about this from an environmental perspective? Well, the Endocrine Society's latest scientific statement states that obesity is a disorder of the energy homeostasis system, and environmental factors, including chemicals, confer obesity risk. And indeed, the rapid increase in obesity and metabolic diseases over the last few decades correlate very closely with substantial increases in environmental chemical production and exposure. And while correlation doesn't imply causation, there are also experimental evidence in animal models that show the ability of various environmental chemicals to induce adiposity and metabolic disruption. At the kind of finer molecular biology level, adipogenesis is regulated by a complex network of transcription factor, and playing the Lion King's role is the PPAR gamma, short for peroxisome proliferator activated receptor gamma, which is a ligand activated nuclear receptor and an essential regulator of adipocyte formation and function. And so we call, in this presentation, we call adipogen those exogenous compounds that can alter white adipocyte function by modifying PPAR gamma activity. And so with this in mind, the goal of our project was to identify by transcriptional assays the so-called adipogens. And more specifically, we wanted to create a classifier to identify novel candidate adipogens, and also to create a taxonomy, an unsupervised taxonomy, to group chemicals based on their effect on PPAR gamma transcriptome and downstream metabolic function. And the hypothesis was that the taxonomy would be able to separate therapeutic ligands, PPAR gamma ligands, from environmental adipogen, which would induce white but not brown or bright adipogenesis. And so the experimental design closely mimics the one adopted for the Cassino Genome Project. We used mouse pre-adipocytes that were exposed to chemicals over a course of 10 days during differentiation, and then were profiled by this. In this case, we used highly multiplex RNA-seq, which is think of it as kind of a cheap form of RNA sequencing, which yields a lower number of reads per sample, but it's accurate enough to basically for our purposes. The chemicals included, there were 76 compounds, including 38 adipogens, 21 non-adipogens, and 17 unknown, okay? Each chemical was profiled in between 2 and 4 replicates, with doses selected as the max non-toxic dose and non-greater than 20 micromolar. So once the data was generated, and functionally annotated, basic computational modeling followed. And the analysis workflow included basically adipogenicity prediction based on a novel classification model, and also establishing an adipogen taxonomy to estimate, to identify subgroups of adipogen, and to segregate, separate, deleterious from therapeutic adipogen. And then there was also functional validation. And so for this analysis, we developed new supervised and unsupervised machine learning approaches. I'm not going to go into the details, but for as far as actually the classification task is concerned, we developed this amended random forest, which really takes advantage of the experimental design where there are multiple replicates per condition. And here we show the classification results of our amended forest classifier as we evaluated by tenfold cross-validation on the training set. The accuracy is very good, measured by area under the ROC curve, 89.89. And in particular, the precision is good, 0.9. The precision, remember, is the probability that something was classified as an adipogen is actually an adipogen. The right plot shows the gene importance, basically, that is how important a gene is to the prediction for each of the 12,000 or so genes that were included in the classifier. And basically, you can see that the expression of CIDEC and RPL13 were the most important, with actually CIDEC being the strongest indicator of PPAR gamma activation and RPL1 the strongest negative indicator. Okay. So this is the classification. Once actually we had optimized the validator classifier, we applied to the classification to the prediction of the 17 unknown compounds. And as you can see, there are several that actually had a voting or a probability of being adipogen greater than 0.5. But actually, if we follow on this set, these are the one classified with high confidence to be adipogens based on a threshold fine-tuned in the training set. And actually, we want to focus on this that are really the one that stick out because there is the discontinuity in the probability. And in particular, actually, I want to point out to these two chemicals, tonalid and quinoxifen, which are the ones actually which we followed up on functionally, experimentally. And so, whoops, what happened? Yes, these are important because they are kind of ubiquitously used. Tonalid is a fragrance that is present in many cosmetic products and many kind of personal care products. And quinoxifen is a fungicide. And if you drink alcohol, you're probably likely to ingest it. The good news is that it leaves low residue. The bad news is the bioaccumulating fish. So, you know, given that fish is basically recommended as part of a diet against obesity, here you are on a conundrum. But anyway, we also perform functional analysis, and this functional analysis confirmed that both quinoxifen and tonalid induce white adipocyte, but not bright adipogenesis. They do not induce also They induce lipid accumulation, but not mitochondrial biogenesis, et cetera. Next, we wanted to go beyond a simply yes or no classification, adipogen versus non-adipogen, and we wanted to see whether we could group adipogen based on their transcriptional profile and on their likely modes of action, let's say. As I said before, basically our hypothesis was that we would be able to segregate therapeutic PPAR gamma ligands, or adipogen, the kind of beneficial adipogens, from the environmental adipogens that are actually not so beneficial. For this task, we also developed a novel unsupervised taxonomy discovery approach that we called K2 taxonomer. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of the algorithm, but this is basically, this algorithm is particularly apt at discovering nested taxonomies through a recursive binary partitioning procedure. And actually, an important and salient property of the algorithm is that each partition is based on a different set of genes or feature, which makes it quite distinct from, say, standard hierarchical clustering, where basically the same set of feature, the same set of genes is used for each split. So application of K2 taxonomer to the set of known and predicted adipogen yielded the shown taxonomy. It's a quite rich taxonomy, but the important part that I want you to take home here is that it separates PPAR gamma agonist from antagonist. It also separates weak from strong agonist, and also environmental from therapeutic agonists. Oops, sorry. Also, notice that it places our new friends, tinoxifen and tonalid, squarely among the environmental adipogens. So this analysis was based on mouse model, and so one question we had was whether the chemical response elicited by this chemical in mouse models would have any human relevance. And to do this, we relied on a publicly available data set of expression profiles from subcutaneous adipose tissue of the MetSyn, short for Metabolic Syndrome in Men project. We wish we had access to a data set that included both men and women, but we were not so lucky, so basically we relied on this data set, which only models metabolism in men. And these profiles were annotated with several clinical measurements of healthy and unhealthy cardiometabolic status. It's a complex analysis, so I'm not going to go into the details of that, but basically we projected each of the signature of up and down regulated genes from each of the taxonomic subgroups onto each of the MetSyn profiles, and that tested for the association between the signature activity and clinical measurements. And it's a sort of complicated and actually very, I would say, elegant analysis. But basically, the take-home message was that, let me stand here for a second. Clinical markers of metabolic health, such as plasma adiponectin and fat-free mass, were positively associated with signature from two taxonomic subgroups, which included all the glitazone and non-glitazone type 2 diabetic drugs. And conversely, putative markers of metabolic dysfunction, such as interleukin-1 receptor antagonist and fasting plasma insulin, were associated with taxonomic subgroups consisting of basically weak PPAR gamma agonism or modification and PPAR gamma activity repression. So this was kind of, in summary, really the show that mouse-based in vitro derived signature captured important functional aspects of healthy and unhealthy metabolic function in human subjects. And this was an important point to make. There was also extensive experimental validation performed by our colleagues Stephanie Kinn and Jennifer Schlesinger in the Department of Public Health, in the School of Public Health at Boston University. And again, I'm not going into the details, but basically really the validation confirmed that the chemicals that we selected for the study, tonalid and quinoxifen, induced lipid accumulation, but not fatty acid uptake, which would be good, but basically was not induced by these chemicals. And while, you know, the positive control is rosiglitazone, which is basically a type 2 diabetes drug, which has all the positive, the hallmarks of a good adipogen, the lipid accumulation, fatty acid uptake, mitochondrial biogenesis. And so this was, again, since the results were too rich to be adequately shared through the traditional vehicle of a written report, we created a web-based portal for the interactive inspection of chemicals and chemical groups, and you can access at that link shown above. In summary, basically, for this part of the talk, we identify new PPAR-gamma agonists and modifiers, new adipogens. We sorted agonists into likely white or bright adipogens. We, in the process, developed new classification, the taxonomy discovery methods, and also the entire framework, experimental analytical framework, I believe has general applicability to studying other adverse phenotypes. And actually, under the auspices of a Superfund supplement, we're working on bringing together the carcinogenome and the epigenome project under a shared roof, which we call the exposome project. Here I use X both to indicate X in exposure and X as a wild card for the adverse effect of interest. Could be carcinogen, adipogen, and you can come up with your X gen, your favorite X gen that you're interested in. This portal is still under construction. I think that if you go to that link, it's not accessible yet, and if it is, it's buggy. So do not use it yet. But I'm hoping that actually within a month or so we will have version 1.0 ready for deployment. And so basically the lesson learned and challenges are many. I'm listing here some. Actually, the logistics on how to procure the chemicals actually was one of the most challenging tasks for the carcinogenome project. Actually, the point about the dose to use for hazard determination is very important, and we can discuss it more later if you want. The importance of distinguishing between acute and chronic exposure with the observation, the realization that low transcriptional response cannot be assumed safe. And despite the fact that actually we are using short-term assays, the models capture important modes of action of carcinogenicity. The wealth of results we produce cannot be adequately shared through publication, and that's why we developed this portal that we hope will be useful to the community. And actually, last point, let me whine a little bit. It's very difficult to fund this effort. There is through the grant mechanism, there is this hypothesis testing bias, and also there is this misplaced request for in vivo validation. And as I pointed out before, I think actually the in vivo validation is partially built in the design, but of course, functional validation of few chosen chemicals is important, but that definitely does not provide the necessary power to show that what you're doing is actually sound and valid. And actually, let me stop by thanking all the collaborators in my lab, Amy Lee and Eric Reed, who basically, Amy graduated last year, Eric graduated last week. David Scher and Jennifer Schlesinger have been amazing collaborators, are still being amazing collaborator. People at the Broad Institute, Aravind Subramanian and his team, people at NTP and IHS, the Superfund at BU, the team, Mark Han, Jack Goldstone, George Stegman, and others, Paola Sebastiani, now at Tufts, and of course the Superfund team, Heather Henry, Bill Suk, Michelle Heacock. They've been amazing, amazing people to work with. And I will stop here, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for giving this presentation. You've given us a lot of information, and we know that we're running low on time, but we can't just let you go without asking a few questions. So the first question is based on your second half of your presentation, and I'm sure you found it very rewarding to see that you could see the signatures in mice, and you could also see this kind of tracking with metabolic function or dysfunction in the human samples you were looking at. What I was wondering is, do you think that you have the capability to be able to see when trouble is brewing? So before maybe you kind of get to that metabolic dysfunction, you can see sort of those markers that start to light up to let you know when somebody might be up for trouble.
That's a great question and a very challenging question to answer. I don't think you can do it in the experimental design that we presented. I think some sort of kind of time series, you know, different time of exposure, and using longer exposure to establish markers, pathway markers or gene markers, and that we can use to look at earlier time of exposure to see whether actually those markers start to deviate from normality. That would be probably the experimental design that I would actually favor for to try to answer the question that you brought up. And so yes, it's totally. I think, of course, the proof is in the pudding. We would have to do it. It's totally feasible, but it would require an even larger data set, of course, where instead of having a single time point, we would have several time points, and possibly several doses at each time point, so as to be basically look at the curves of basically deviation from normality and how this arise over time. I don't know if this answer satisfactory to your question. Hello? Did I lose you?
Michelle, you're on mute.
I sure did have myself on mute. Yes, you answered the question. Thank you, Stefano. So the next question is also geared towards the second half of your presentation, but I think it could be applicable to the first half as well. And this question is based on thinking about how chemicals have to be metabolized first. You know, this question came from metabolized first before affecting fat or adipocyte storage. How did you account for this in your assays when you're using adipocytes? And also thinking about the first half for your presentation, how were you thinking about looking at liver metabolism, things like that, when you were looking at profiles such as what you see in using breast cells, for example, in your tissues that were meant to look at breast cancer?
Yes, absolutely. This is a well-known quote-unquote challenge. I think actually, well, in the first case, carcinogenemia, clearly it's not by chance that we use liver as our first order, our first way of tackling the problem, exactly because we did not have to deal with that problem. And we wanted to see whether actually under good condition we could predict, and the answer was yes. But there are standard ways in which you kind of simulate in a petri dish sort of some of the steps of metabolizing the chemical. One could argue that those kind of metabolizing a petri dish simulation sort of is not really representative of what happens in the full organism. But I think we have to live with that, and I think. I think it would be worth trying, basically, both for the carcinogenicity endpoint as well as for the metabolic endpoint. I think for the metabolic endpoint is probably less necessary. But yes, basically including these kind of cofactors that induce this kind of metabolic incorporation. So yes, it can be done. And of course, you can go beyond the single, simple cell. You know, we were dreaming about using organoids, but that's not being realized yet. But yeah, that would be another possibility.
Okay, thank you. This next question is more of a general question that could apply for, you know, the couple of the tools that you presented today. And this one is asking. You know, first, many exposures operate during critical windows. are you able to estimate the age of highest vulnerability?
Oh, wow. That's a great question, a very challenging one. And I think also that, you know, when we started this project, we were dreaming of using iPSC-derived cells at different stages of differentiation and so forth. And one can hypothesize that actually using those models, where basically you use cells at different stages of differentiation and so forth, might help answering the question you're talking about. I think those are questions that, at least with the experimental design that I presented today, I don't think are answerable. But again, by using more sophisticated in vitro or in vivo models, I think they can be tackled. Whether answered successfully, that's another story. We would have to do it. We would have to test it. But I think they can be tackled. And as I said, my favorite approach was also because here at BU we have the CRAM, which is the Center for Regenerative Medicine, with whom we collaborate. We were really hoping to be able to move from, you know, fully transformed cells to actually iPSC-derived cells and at different stages of differentiation and test actually how different is the effect of exposure, you know, at the embryonal state or at later stages.
Absolutely. Last question. This one has to do with going back to the first part of your presentation when you talked about transcriptomic bioactivity does not necessarily correspond to carcinogenicity, but carcinogenicity does display transcriptomic bioactivity. So just asking you to clarify that, and also if you could, we could add an extra layer to that. What does that tell us about the dose we use in an experiment and what kind of readout we get?
Yes. I know that this is a point that is somewhat hard to grasp, or maybe not, I don't know. But basically what I'm saying is that bioactivity is necessary to use a profile for prediction. Means that, you know, in order for a profile to be useful, I have to have changes in expression, right? And in order to have these changes in expression, I have to have a sufficiently high dose that it induces these changes in expression. So if I have too low a dose, basically the expression profile is quote-unquote flat, and therefore if I use that profile for model building, that profile is not going to be useful. But that does not translate, and that's why I'm talking about the distinction between cancer hazard versus cancer risk prediction model, and this is more properly defined as a cancer hazard prediction model. The dose that we use to predict carcinogenicity is not the dose that we expect to be the one necessary to induce carcinogenicity in humans. It's just basically the dose that we need in order to actually perturb the system enough that actually that system can be used for predictive purposes. I don't know if I made myself clearer, but so how to go from this to actually being able to predict the dose that in a human would be risky, would be cancer risk. That's a very challenging question, and is not answered by this model. We would need to, of course, perform dose response modeling, and dose response modeling in vitro models, and map them to those response models in vivo, but we did not have the richness of data to do this kind of modeling. So we're saying is basically that our model predict cancer hazard, that is exposure to this chemical at some dose that we don't know which one it is, is likely to induce cancer. On the other hand, the fact that actually we used known human carcinogen and non-carcinogen to train the model suggests that actually the dose that is necessary to induce carcinogen in human is probably a dose that is within the realm of possibility. I don't know if I made myself clear, but
No, absolutely, absolutely. I think the point is that you've got a really promising tool. All you need is just some more data points.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that this model by itself would be sufficient, say, for a regulatory agency to determine whether a chemical is safe or not. It's one tool in a regulatory pipeline for prioritizing chemicals that would probably need to go through further testing in much more kind of realistic and kind of human relevant models.
No, absolutely. And I think you made that point at the beginning when you were making the good point that there are so many chemicals out there, and it's just really hard to get a sense of which ones are going to be the ones that are going to cause the trouble. And so these tools are a nice way to get that first pass to have an idea of whether or not follow-up is needed. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Stefano, for doing this. We realize that you had to do this at a turn without the other presenters, but this will be tucked in with the other presentations in session four. So with that, we're going to conclude today's webinar. If you have any questions, especially since that you're going to be watching a recorded version of this presentation, you're welcome to reach out to Stefano Monti directly by email. His email is on the seminar homepage. It's on Cluin. Again, I'd like to thank you again, Stefano, for taking the time to prepare your presentation, taking the time to reschedule. We're so glad that you're on the mend, and hopefully your recovery time is fast. And again,
thank you so much, Michelle.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing So this concludes today's presentation. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And again, if you have any questions for the presenter, you can feel free to please email him using the email that's provided.